Good morning, everybody. Welcome to another Dive into James. This morning, we're going to be looking at chapter 4, verses 1 to the beginning of verse 6. We're going to cover all of verse 6. I was going to try and get to verse 10, but there was just too much to say on the way, so we're going to leave the rest for another time. So let's crack on. It would be great if you can follow along in your own Bibles or one of the Bibles that's on the table. This bit of the Bible can be found, and I'm going to need your help now because I forgot to write this down while I was sitting there. Which page in the brown NIV Bibles, anybody? 1215. Blue Good News Bibles, anyone got that one open? Give me the page number. Oh, don't worry, I'll shout it out in a minute if we get it. I did write down, ar tudalen 1463 mewn y fersiwn Bible.net. But, okay, I'm going to read out of the NIV version. 1209, sorry, the Good News Bibles. What causes fights and quarrels among you? Don't they come from your desires that battle within you? You desire, but you do not have, so you kill. You covet, but you cannot get what you want, so you quarrel and fight. You do not have because you do not ask God. When you ask, you do not receive because you ask with wrong motives, that you may spend what you get on your pleasures. You adulterous people, don't you know that friendship with the world means enmity against God? Therefore, anyone who chooses to be a friend of the world becomes an enemy of God. Or do you think Scripture says without reason that he jealously longs for the Spirit he's caused to dwell in us? But he gives us more grace. That is why the Scripture says God opposes the proud but shows favour to the humble. So, it's another punchy one from James, but we're expecting nothing less now, hopefully. We've got to know his style a bit. I think it's always worth getting our bearings when we look at a passage in the Bible. Hopefully, you can remember from the last talk where we looked at the end of chapter 3. If not, cast your eye over it now. And here, James is looking at the nature of wisdom and pulling apart the difference between earthly, air quotes, wisdom and heavenly wisdom, i.e. true wisdom. Now, I'm not sure if everyone is aware of this, but the original Bible texts, in this case, it's a letter from James, they didn't have chapter numbers, verse numbers or headings, the ones that we find in our Bibles today. These were added in later years by well-meaning compulsive organisers. Now, I'm not totally against this added organisation because it definitely makes it easier to find things quickly and to know that we're all talking about the same bit of text. However, the downside is that we can miss the flow of what the original writer was trying to say because we tend to work with divisions as they're presented to us. But it's always worth bearing in mind they've been added by somebody. So, James's discussion at the beginning of chapter 4 flows on from what he's just been saying at the end of chapter 3. And it's a deeper dive into the earthly wisdom that he's already introduced, with some more specific application, which is probably the gentlest word for it, for the hearer, about the ways that this earthly wisdom has actually infiltrated the thinking and behaviour of God's church, because that is who James is writing to. We can't forget that when we read these things that he says. He's not talking to non-Christians, he's talking to Christians. So, yeah, it's pretty close to the bone, but I think that's probably good. Finally, he's providing the solution to returning to godly wisdom, which, as you'll remember, is actually a way of describing a whole life through humility. So let's work our way through the verses and see what they've got to say to us. So James begins this extended thought on earthly wisdom at large in the church in verse 1 by posing a question. And interestingly, we find that Jesus in the Gospels, and actually God throughout the whole Bible, uses questions a lot to draw out truth from people's hearts. So James's question is worth us actually trying to honestly answer before we just run on to his answer. So he says, what causes fights and quarrels among you? So if we just stop there and think about this, Maybe even try to recall to mind a recent quarrel or a fight or a disagreement, whichever euphemism you prefer. How would you answer this? It's not hard for me. I can think of one that happened literally last night. my bad. But if we were honest, how would we... Sorry. Probably had one this morning too, yeah. But if we were honest, how would we answer the question? Well, if I think about this first in terms of my kids, because it's always easier to think about somebody else rather than yourself. If I hear a squabble or a fight escalating to unacceptable levels of rudeness or violence, and I end up calling the involved parties to halt proceedings and come and tell me, probably individually, what's going on from their perspective, I would say more often than not, they will list the crimes of the other person. And again, fairly often, they'll link this to the reason why they've done whatever they've done in response. Now, to give my children credit, sometimes they answer very honestly and they admit that they were to blame. However, it was his fault or it was her fault is often the key message. But before you think I'm being overly harsh on my lovely but flawed children, I think we all tend towards this response to James's question. What causes fights and quarrels among you? Well, other people, obviously. I wasn't shouting until they provoked me. I wasn't rude until they were selfish. I wasn't arguing my point until they made an extreme and inflammatory comment. I didn't feel resentful until they gave me something to resent. What caused the fight? Well, they did. Now, I am hopeful and I'm actually sure that some of us here will have journeyed with Jesus long enough to have actually developed different responses, at least some of the time. But many of us, and I'm including myself here, if we were to answer this question honestly, we'd join in with the cry of my kids, it was their fault. Having asked us to search our hearts for an answer, James now lays out an alternative answer in the rest of verses 1 and verse 2, because he says the war begins within us. Our passions are at war within us, says James, long before there's a war between us. James points us back to his claims in chapter 3, verse 16, that at the heart of earthly wisdom lies jealousy and selfish ambition. 4 verse 2 says, we desire and we do not have, we covet and we cannot obtain, which in other words means we're jealous and we're selfish. And this description of envy and jealousy being at the heart of human conflict is actually not a unique observation for James. In ancient Greek thinking, this connection was commonly made between envy and jealousy and quarrels, violence, murder, war. And in the Gospels, actually, in both Matthew and Mark, we hear Pilate, as a Gentile ruler, observing, quite insightfully, that envy is actually the reason the chief priests want to see Jesus killed. He can see their action isn't coming from the claimed religious objections, but from the much more universal motivation of envy. My main man, Douglas Moo, sums it up well. James provides us with a powerful analysis of human conflict. Verbal argument, private violence, or national conflict, the cause of them all can be traced back to the frustrated desire to want more than we have, to be envious and covet what others have, whether it be their position or possessions. And I would add, their abilities or their appearance, or even their maturity and freedom. We can probably assume from the context and tone of what James is saying that he's not literally accusing the Christians he's writing to of murder. Although, sadly, if we are honest, how many millions of Christians have died at the hands of other Christians over the past 2,000 plus years? Too many to count. But even if actual murder has not been committed, we only have to think back to Jesus' teaching in Matthew 5, which I'm sure is in James's mind, to know that hate and anger as inner attitudes and harsh words on the outside towards our brothers and sisters, even if we don't carry them through to their extreme murderous conclusion, carries serious consequences in terms of God's judgment. So none of us are excluded from this warning. This is not comfortable reading, but it's very much in line with the teachings of Jesus, who constantly was calling his hearers to look first to their own hearts. Remember the speck and the log situation? To their own flawed motivations and selfish desires, to take the state of our inner lives seriously before we turn our gaze or the blame onto others. The war is within us before it is between us. I heard a really helpful illustration of this idea a few years ago. Imagine that we all carry around a bottle full of liquid, but this bottle has got no lid on it. So when we bang into someone or they bang into us, the liquid in our bottle spills out. Now, if we've got a bottle that's filled with anger or resentment, insecurity, anxiety, envy or selfishness, this is what gets spilled. They may have bumped into us, but it's only what's already carried around inside of us that spills out. Now, other people will bump into us. Their actions and sin and weakness will interrupt and affect our lives. Sometimes this is on purpose, often it's without even realizing it. But whatever the reason, it's not really something we can directly control. Their sin or their failing or brokenness is beyond our power to avoid or change. The alternative to focusing on what made us spill is to use each of these conflicts or hurts to take an honest look at what has spilled out of us. Now, really important to hear that I'm not victim blaming. That could not be further from the truth. Biblically, there are at least three dimensions to sin. And I'm essentially now just rehashing what John Mark Comer says in his book, Practicing the Way, just to give credit. When we discuss sin, we really should try and hold all three in our minds at the same time. Because number one is the sin done by us. And we rightfully tend to focus on this. But just as important, number two is the sin done to us and the sin done around us. We often just focus on number one, but the effects of two and three are just as relevant because we might be filled with terrible things, not because of a choice we've made to sin, but because of a terrible sin done to us, either by an individual or by society and culture. And far from throwing blame or shame, God weeps for this brokenness we've received, and he's reaching out to us with his healing love. But interestingly, whatever the source of the sin damage, and it is important to unravel this individually, the solution to what is in our bottle is the same. We can offer that anger, or that pain, or that brokenness, or that selfishness to him and swap it for a fresh filling of his healing love, which in turn will grow the fruits of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, kindness, etc. Because the hopeful aspect of this analogy is that if we're filled with the love of God for us, his peace, his gentleness, if we're secure in his love and care and guidance over all that happens in our lives, then this is what spills out. Even when we are sinned against, even if someone bangs into us with evil intent. And it's this possibility, and I've gone on a bit, but this is so key because it's at the heart of the radical enemy love that is one of Jesus' most unique and profound teachings. As always, this is a process. We do experience specific powerful moments of healing from sin of all three types, and these are so special. But overall, I would say, we become people who spill out love through a lifetime of small daily choices to offer ourselves and our brokenness to God and open ourselves to his love. Now, another word for that two-stage process is submission. And we're going to look really much more deeply into that at the beginning of the next talk. So, moving into the end of verse 2 and 3, we can see that at the heart of the conflict between Christians is a lack of heavenly wisdom, which always has a focus on God, and the presence of earthly wisdom, which always focuses on the self. For some people, James says, this looks like a lack of prayer. You do not have because you do not ask God. Now, this could be because they're trying to fix things themselves. It is amazing how many Christians still feel that certain things are too small or personal to bother God with. Or in reality, it could be because they're priding themselves, quietly or otherwise, on being self-sufficient, independent. Not one of the children God really needs to exert too much effort for. He can save his interventions for the really messed up ones. But of course, we know that however reasonable or even responsible this might seem at a quick glance, this is earthly wisdom. As James would say, set on fire by hell. Or perhaps it's because his hearers are happier looking to people or possessions, other sources of provision than God. Maybe there's a lack of trust in his promise to be all that they need, or a hesitancy to fully commit themselves to his care. But whatever the reason that they do not ask God, this is still earthly wisdom through and through. because God has told us to ask. He said he cares about the details of the lives of small birds. How much more the details of our lives? He's told us that he's kind and he's a generous father. He said he's trustworthy. He's told us that we need saving. He's told us that we're like sheep without a shepherd, that we're sick and we need a doctor, that we're children in need of a parent. Now for others in verse 3, a central misunderstanding about who God is, who we are, and as a consequence how we relate to him is expressed in prayer, but prayer with a worldly, earthly perspective. When you ask, you do not receive because you ask with wrong motives, that you may spend what you get on your pleasures. So it's a self-focused approach to the God of self-giving love. It's basically seeing salvation and by an extension prayer as a kind of transaction. I say this to you, you give that to me, boom, everybody's happy. Doesn't see it as a relationship. It's viewing prayer as kind of a way to enable individual gain. And sadly, we see a lot of this in Christian Western, particularly Western Christian culture, the kind of prosperity gospel idea, rather than prayer as a way to enter a self-giving community of love. James is really clear that this type of prayer does not lead to receiving the things we ask for. Because how could the God of love lovingly say yes to a request to dive deep into selfishness and sin? Now, when Jesus famously taught his disciples how to pray, it was in a way that firstly focused their hearts and minds upon God's nature and his purposes. The Lord's Prayer, as we might know it, begins with remembering how we relate to God. The first words, he is our, first of all, it's a communal prayer, by the way, not individual, our Father. Then, it's with remembering his position of ultimate authority over everything, who is in heaven. He not only cares and is for us as our dad, but he's able to help and act with authority because he's in charge. He's also different to us. He's set apart. Again, unlike turning to a human source of help, he can respond in ways that are not our ways. Holy is your name. That's what it means. With the focus set, the prayer then leads into an act of chosen submission to God's good rule and to his will being carried out primarily in our own hearts and lives and then on into the world around us. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Finally then, Jesus shifts the focus of the prayer to our needs and our requests. And this is not because they aren't important, they are a really important part of the prayer, but because the focus of our hearts and minds needs to first be set on him, in order that we can actually receive the provision, the protection, the forgiveness and the love that he's longing to pour out. Our perspective on our needs and our desires for ourselves becomes shaped by the God we're gazing at and not the other way around. So, having thoroughly convinced us as hearers that there are some major problems in our shared lives, to say the least, James is going to spend the rest of the passage leading us through the process of putting this right. No, James hasn't quite finished with the problem yet. If you didn't feel that James had been clear enough about the seriousness of the situation where earthly wisdom, fueled by jealousy, envy, and selfishness, has infiltrated the thinking and operation of the church family, damaging relationships and prayer lives, do not fear, because he's now pulling out the big guns. He is going to go full Old Testament prophet on us. In verse 4, James calls his Christian brothers and sisters adulterous people. Ouch. It sounds really harsh. It's definitely a diss, isn't it? But does he need to be that weirdly rude? I mean, we've had a brief mention of adultery so far, but he's not really majored on it. There's been a lot more about our words or about favoritism. So why doesn't he call them slanderous people or prejudiced people? Fair questions. But the reference here for all of his original, mainly Jewish listeners would have been immediately clear. The relationship between God and his people throughout the Old Testament was often described as a marriage. God is the groom, and Israel, the Jewish nation, was his bride. And actually, the New Testament picks up this language, talking about Jesus and his church. And in this picture language, when his people turn their backs on him, as they repeatedly did, on his ways, his laws, or his prophets, they were described as being like an adulterous wife. Jeremiah 3:20 says, "But like an unfaithful wife, you have not been faithful to me." Or in the book, the whole book of Hosea, where the prophet is called out to live this picture language in a sort of mad and beautiful soap opera prophecy. Jesus also uses the same allegorical Old Testament language in Matthew 12:39 and 16:4, when he responds to the Pharisees and Sadducees who are asking for a sign by calling them an evil and adulterous generation. So, this was a major calling out by James of his hearers. The Christians that James is writing to might not have been secretly worshipping Aphrodite or Caesar, but they're living their lives based on earthly wisdom. They're giving precedence to the principles and impulses that the world, the flesh, and the devil offer, rather than making their choices and forming their characters around God's ways and priorities. James puts all this into the memorable phrase, friendship with the world, in verse 4. Now, don't misunderstand James here. He is talking in the context of our inner allegiance. So remember, all the time so far, we've heard James discussing divided living, the dipsychos, or the double soul, double-minded person. The doubt he mentions in chapter 1, which actually isn't really about intellectual questioning or an emotional response to difficult questions. It's in fact about not making up your mind about who you're going to devote yourself to, trying to keep your options open. It's the reality of who or what we're actually being a disciple of, who has our heart. Now, Jesus was called friend of sinners, which was meant as an insult by the religious elite of the time, but it accurately described the astonishing way that he lived amongst the brokenness of sin in people, loving and welcoming them as they were. The religious leaders used the term to suggest that he was tainted by and endorsing the sin in the people around him, that by being with them, he was signing off their behavior, and who knows, even indulging in it himself. But although Jesus welcomed sinners and actively pursued friendship with them, he argued, the reason he did this, he argued that it was only the sick that needed a doctor when the Pharisees are having a go at him for it. He didn't actually become a friend of the world in the way that James means it, in terms of allegiance, because his allegiance to and relationship of loving obedience with his Father was completely unshaken. Jesus never endorsed or encouraged earthly attitudes or behavior in the sinners that he befriended and loved. In fact, his whole mission was about declaring God's kingdom was near and calling people to leave their old lives and enter God's kingdom, to leave the kingdom of this world and enter the completely different, love-fueled, topsy-turvy kingdom of heaven. And ultimately, he was going to die and raise back to life again to make that possible. Jesus himself explained to Pilate, "My kingdom is not of this world." When in verse 4, James reminds his hearers that you choose to be God's enemy if you won't give up friendship with the world, he's only echoing Jesus' teaching. This is war, and there is no neutral ground. If you're not on my side, you're the enemy. If you're not helping, you're making things worse. Those are Jesus' words from Matthew 12:30 in the Message. Or in the language of kingdom, which Jesus so often used, you can't live in two kingdoms. If you're living in Clawddnewydd, you're living in Wales, not France. You could wear a beret and a stripy t-shirt, sing Je ne regrette rien, eat baguettes and celebrate Bastille Day, but you still wouldn't be in France. Sorry, Gez. You'd yeah. Despite doing all those things, you still don't end up in France, do you? Still in Wales. The only solution, if you really want to be in France, is you have to leave Wales and go to France. So either God has ultimate authority in your life and you're living in his kingdom, or you're not, and then you're living as his enemy. James wants to shock his readers into action. Being an enemy of God is serious, especially when you bear in mind, as I said before, James is talking to Christians here, not unbelievers. These are people who've already supposedly given their allegiance and their life to God. So these attitudes of selfishness and envy within the church, not to mention neglect of the poor, favoritism, destructive use of language, which is all implied so far, these aren't minor issues. They're actually putting the church at war with the very God they claim to serve. And who is likely to win, says James. I think there's quite a lot for us to consider here. Because the dangers are, if anything, more significant now, I think, than they were then. Because how many more channels of input are we exposed to? Remember, we're talking about our heart's allegiance, the principles that guide our life. How many other voices do we hear on a daily basis calling for our agreement, attempting to enter our minds by blunt force or stealth to influence the way we think, vote, act? Probably most often the way we spend our money. Because in today's increasingly online economy, attention equals money. The longer you're on a site or streaming service and they've got your attention, or the more clicks or subscriptions, the more money and influence somebody ultimately has. The battle for our minds and our wallets is fierce, and we can't afford to be ignorant. If we've got a favourite TV show, a YouTube channel, a podcast or celebrity, or if you're sitting there feeling smug because you're like, I'm old school, I'm afraid the same still applies to friends, books and radio stations. If the messages from these places are forming our ideas and attitudes towards the world and life and ourselves with more depth and meaning for us than God, than what he has to say about us and himself and others, well, we're really in danger of living as his enemy. So, verse 5, it's a bit of a pickle to translate. I read it out in the NIV version, but if you read it in another version, it can seem like it's saying something quite different. Basically, without going into it, it is confusing, and scholars can't agree because they don't quite know whose spirit's jealous and whose spirit we're talking about. And needless to say, it doesn't actually, either way you read it, it doesn't disagree with anything that the Bible hasn't already said. And it doesn't really take away from anything James is saying. So we're just going to kind of smoothly move on. I think we've probably covered it, really. Finally, we are on to verse 6, which sees some light, more than light, relief. I'm reminded that the disciples, their slightly defeated whinge to Jesus, after hearing about the commitment levels required to enter the kingdom of God in Matthew 19. Who then can be saved? To which Jesus replies, with man, this is impossible. But with God, all things are possible. And James starts verse 6 with these amazing words, that he gives us more grace. Phew, big relief. The Greek word used is charis, or charis, I don't know how you say it in Greek, which in ancient Hebrew is the word chen, which apparently that is how you say it. James, being a Jew, is soaked in and taking his understanding of this word from the Old Testament. Now, in some contexts in the Old Testament, it describes something that creates a good response or that we find ourselves drawn towards. It's describing something beautiful, like a treasure. So God is sometimes described as chen to point us towards his beauty, how he's like a precious treasure that we're drawn towards. It also can often be found in the phrase to find chen in the eyes of. So to find favor in the eyes of, to find grace in the eyes of somebody. So it's describing this idea of favor. So when someone who is asking to be treated as treasured and precious, or someone who is just being treated in that way. Now, all 47 times that this phrase appears in the Old Testament, it involves someone of a higher status relating to someone of a lower status. So the person is asking to find favor with them because they're not entitled to it due to the difference in their position. Or it's a significant moment because the person of higher status is giving favor when that person of lower status isn't entitled to it. So someone described as being full of grace, or chen, which turns to chanun when it's an adjective, would be someone who's consistently favorable or treasuring of people of lower status. Sorry, I can see people laughing in the back because we watched the Barbie movie last night. And obviously Ken is quite significant. I am Kenneth. I am Kenneth. Yeah, he needs grace. That's probably the moral of that movie, really. But anyway, sorry, just had to get that one out there because I was wanting to laugh myself. Back to chanun, which is what we're on to now, the adjective to describe someone who's full of grace, is someone who's consistently favorable or treasuring of people of lower status. So when we read that the Lord is gracious in Psalm 103, we're being told that God is consistently our doting parent, bending down to interact with, to help, discipline, teach, provide for, and comfort his beloved child, however that child has acted or behaved. So one way to think about the idea that we find favour or grace in the eyes of God, which incredibly we do, is to know that if we were to look up any time at our Daddy God's face as he's bending down to us, his child probably yet again in a mess, we only find favour, love and kindness glistening in his eyes, flowing from his heart of unchanging love towards us. He is treasuring us and we can see it in his face. We would find favour in his eyes if we only looked. Put in another way, he is for you all the time. Now, James has already described this idea in chapter 1, verse 17, when he reminded us about our gift-giving Father of lights. James is saying here, again, in chapter 4, 6, that despite the absolute mess that we might be in, a mess which he's just described in detail, God is still the gracious, unchanging, good Father that we met in chapter 1, who is showering constantly gifts of love upon us. And he's got ever more of this attitude of loving kindness available to meet our need as we humble ourselves before him and acknowledge that we're in need of this grace. Because verse 6 rounds off, and I am rounding off, so well done everybody, you've kept with me. It rounds off by bringing us back to the heart of a wise life that we looked at in chapter 3, and it's humility. God opposes the proud, but shows favour to the humble. And he's quoting from Proverbs then. If you can remember from last time, heavenly wisdom begins with the acknowledgement that we need help. Remember, anyone, what the first thing you need is when faced with an emergency? Anyone remember what you need to have before you need a first aid certificate? Or what do you need? You need to realise that you need help. If you don't realise you're in an emergency, if you don't realise there's an emergency, you aren't going to ask for help, are you? You're just going to sit there burning. So, or whatever the emergency might be. And this is where humility comes in. That's why it's the beginning of wisdom. Because unless we realise, yes, God, I need help. I need you to help me. You are the one with the authority and the power. I am the one that doesn't really deserve it, but I need you to help me. That's humility. And that, connected in with grace, means that he can save us. So this humility unlocks our hearts and opens the way for God's love and rescue to enter. And we are reminded from this quote in Proverbs that to take the opposite approach, to be proud and unwilling to acknowledge that we need God's grace towards us, is actually taking up a position of opposition to God. If we aren't being humble, we're choosing enmity with God. There isn't any neutral ground. So I'm going to leave it there for today, although I'm very excited to get onto the next verses because they're some of my favourite verses in the whole of James. But just before we finish, I'm going to offer up a prayer to God for us all now.